In today's world, it feels like some people shout their hate but whisper their love. But some voices, some stories, are fighting back, and with luck, their power can change the world. Welcome to the Fantasy Inn, where we share our love for all things fantasy and discuss the broader speculative fiction industry. I'm your host, Travis Tippins. This week's interview is with author T.J. Klune. His novel Heartsong is available now from Tor Books in hardcover, and Somewhere Beyond the Sea releases in September 2024. T.J. and I discuss writing romance, managing expectations of different audiences, and the importance of books as both escapism and refuge. And with that, let's jump to the good part. Okay, well, welcome to the Fantasy Inn, TJ. It's so great to have you on the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me here. I appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, we were talking right before we hit record, and this is my return to podcasting after a couple years hiatus. So I am thrilled to be back podcasting and even more thrilled to have you as the guest to bring me back. So
that is amazing. Welcome back. I'm sure all your listeners are going to be super excited to see this pop up in their feeds.
Yeah, I hope so. I'll try to give them some advance notice so it's not a total surprise. But yeah. So I guess starting off with the hardball questions, after learning you're a tea enthusiast and reading Under the Whispering Door, I kind of just want to ask, what's your go-to tea?
Oh my God, this is going to get me in so much trouble. So a few years ago, when Under the Whispering Door came out, we were still kind of pandemic-y. And so there was some in-person events, but they were very far and few between. So I did a lot of online stuff. And one of the launch event was with author V.E. Schwab, who is just a remarkable person and, you know, very, very famous and very successful with her books. She wanted to host the launch for that. And before we did that, we were talking back and forth, and she was like, we should drink tea while we're doing this because it's about the tea shop. And I said, yeah, absolutely. That sounds great. Little did I know that Ms. Schwab would get on camera live without any warning to me and pull out the most beautiful tea set that she had in the world. She had all these loose leaf teas and these colored things that looked perfect. And she goes, and TJ, what are you drinking right now? And I said, I'm drinking my Bigelow spiced orange tea that I got from Target. And that was the time that Miss Schwab then turned around and goes, TJ, you're a basic bitch. And I said, yeah. So honestly, though, my favorite tea of all time, and it's, again, it's a basic bitch answer, but it's English breakfast tea. And it's PG Tips English breakfast tea. That's a UK tea that I discovered when I went to the UK for a month in 2016. And that's all I would love to drink from this point on.
Okay. Well, isn't that something that you can find over here pretty easily?
Yeah, if you go, not anymore, because now I live in the mountains in the middle of nowhere away from everybody, but I can buy it online, so it's fine.
Okay, there you go. Yeah, I'm always looking for more hot beverages. I'm more of a coffee guy myself, but I also love tea. So,
oh, coffee, man. With my ADHD, me and caffeine are not the best combination, and coffee just, it's basically a version of heroin. And I'm just like, okay, well, now I'm seeing colors and tasting them too. And this is wonderful. And then I crash and it sucks. So that's why I don't drink coffee.
I think that's understandable. Yeah. Well, okay. So one of the actual interview questions I always like to start off with people is just asking, can you remember what made you first fall in love with books and reading?
Yeah, absolutely. So I grew up in Oregon. I was born in the 80s, came of age in the 90s, and I lived in rural Oregon and in a very poor area of Oregon. And we were well below the poverty line. So books and anything extra were considered luxuries that we could not afford. But the thing is, man, I loved books. I loved reading. I loved words. I loved everything about them. I talked enough to fill a billion books, and I loved books. Unfortunately, I grew up in a household that was not conducive to letting kids be themselves. So I learned very early on that things that brought me joy were things that would be taken away from me. I didn't have parents that were loving and understanding and protective over their children, especially me, who knew he was queer by the age 11, 12 years old. And I was an effeminate kid. So imagine being an effeminate kid in the 80s and 90s in rural Oregon with parents. I mean, I can say this because it's where I'm from. My entire family is essentially white trash. That's what we were. That's what we are. And it's that kind of environment doesn't do well for a kid like me or other kids like me. And so I did this thing when I was a kid where one time we went into town, got a library card, and that was my lifeline from that point on. Every day during the summer, I would ride my bike into town, go to the library when open, stay there until it closed. All day I read. I read anything and everything I could get my hands on. I read fiction. I read nonfiction. I read books that were probably far above my age level that I should not have been reading at that age. Like most people of that era, I grew up reading Stephen King at a very early age. The very first book I read by him was The Stand, the complete and uncut edition, which is like 1,500 pages. I didn't understand 90% of it, but I knew I was enthralled by it. I knew I was enthralled. So much so that I wanted to tell my own stories. So when I was 6 or 7 years old, I started carrying a notebook around with me that I would fill with whatever came into my head. And, you know, they were ramblings of a child, and essentially, looking back, probably amount to nothing more than fan fiction, because I was always writing about me and the character from the video game Metroid, Samus, going around and killing space aliens, because that character had a gun for an arm. But the thing that blew my mind was, after you beat the game at the very end, the character of Samus takes off their helmet and reveals they're a woman, and you've been playing a woman the whole time, when you thought at the very beginning that, like video games are, they were a boy kind of thing and a boy was the main character. But no, it was a woman, but you didn't know that till the end. And that set my imagination on fire, because, I mean, granted, at that age, I wouldn't have understood the concept of a twist, but I still got it enough that it broke my brain open, so much so that I would just write all of these stories about me and Samus going around and saving the world. And those were things, again, that I had to hide, because if it got found out that I was doing something that made me happy, I would never be able to do it again, or I would get in trouble for it, or I would, you know, I don't want to say there was any physical abuse. I'm not saying that there wasn't either, but sometimes there can be things that are worse than fists. Psychological and mental abuse can be just as bad, especially to a kid who's still thinking. I mean, let's put it this way. Parents should never make fun of their kids for reading, ever, 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 ever.
Yep.
And that may have been kept secret. That may have been my so-called secret shame until I got to seventh grade. I had two teachers, Mrs. Benson, Mrs. Pfeiffer. They were my English teachers. They were the first people in my life to tell me I was good at something. And that happened to be writing. In my very last class with them, I was a gawky 11, 12 year old boy. In my very last class with them, they told me one day they would see my name on a book in a bookstore. I am here because of those two women. They are responsible for me growing up to do what I do. And I am positive proof of the power that teachers can have over their students.
Yeah, that is amazing. I hope that they have seen your name on books in the bookstore.
Unfortunately,
I don't know if you've gotten a chance to touch base with them.
Yeah, no, unfortunately, they were both older when I had them as teachers, okay. And they have since passed. But very, very interesting side story. For the first time in my life, I went back to that small town last year for the release of my last novel, In the Lives of Puppets. I went back to the same library that saved my life as a kid. Instead of, though, using that place as escape, I was there to talk about my own book. And I told the story of Mrs. Benz and Mrs. Pfeiffer, because I knew there were people in the audience I'd gone to school with. There were people in the audience that knew my family. There were people in the audience that knew me from when I'd lived there. But what I didn't know was that there was also someone else in the audience, and that happened to be Mrs. Benz's best friend. And she called Mrs. Benz's son after the event to tell him what I'd said. And he replied that that sounds just like his mother, and that he has heard multiple stories over the years from kids who had her as a teacher. Had I not chosen to go back to the town that caused me so much anger, so much grief, so much heartbreak, I never would have had that small little human moment that meant everything to me. That's there's no... That full circle moment is something that I could not have imagined in my wildest dreams, and it meant the world to me. It meant everything.
Yeah, that's incredible. I love hearing stories like that. Reading is obviously a very important part of my life as well. And it's just incredible to hear how people can, I don't know, connect over that and also just impact the next generation by, I mean, kindness. Oh,
absolutely. Especially, it's kind of funny, especially since my English teacher the next year in eighth grade once told me that I should just give up now because nobody will ever like my writing. Had I not had Mrs. Benson, wow. Mrs. Pfeiffer the year before, that might have killed me. That probably would have killed me because I was a kid with such low confidence. But you know what? I remembered what Mrs. Benson, Mrs. Pfeiffer had told me. Was I upset? Of course I was. Did I get hard on myself? Absolutely. Did I feel down and angry and disappointed? Absolutely. But I remembered what Mrs. Benson, Mrs. Pfeiffer said. And I remember that a lot of people have told me throughout my life, and I think it's so true, people love things quietly, but they hate loudly. And when you get that kind of hate, and you know, obviously I can't prescribe motivations to this eighth grade teacher, but at the same time, I knew what love felt like. I got that from Mrs. Benson, Mrs. Pfeiffer, and that was enough to keep me going.
Yeah. So on the note of reading and loving books and all of that, I do really appreciate the advice that you have before for writers that, you know, read as much as you write.
Oh, please do. Please, please, please read anything and everything you can get your hands on.
Yeah. So for you and your reading, how do you go about selecting your next book? Because I imagine you have a lot of constraints on your time. It might be hard to separate work from, you know, pleasure reading. Mm-hmm. I'm just curious, how do you go about it?
So I was on tour last week for the release of a re-release of a book. And one of the questions I got asked while I was on stage was, what are some of my favorite things to read? Not what specific books, but favorite things to read. And it came out. And I am so happy that I got to talk about this because I think that there's some kind of stigma along with it. But you know, paperback airport thrillers, that whole log line of what we call the paperback airport thriller, the book that comes out in paperback and the title is The Woman in the Window Who Saw a Murder and Now She Has to Hide or something like that, whatever. They're always the same titles, the same. I devour those, man. I was on a 4-hour flight. I picked up a 250-page paperback thriller. I can't even tell you the name off the top of my head right now, but I read that thing from cover to cover, from the end of the flight to the beginning of the flight to the end of the flight, and I had a blast with it. It's just some authors will say, oh, you should read high-class literature. You should do this. Read the classics. Do this. No, read whatever makes you happy. I love horror. Horror is my bread and butter. I love any and all types of horror. To how I select a book, if a cover looks spooky and the blurb about the book catches my interest and even remotely, I'm there. Oh, it has a ghost? Sure. Is it haunted forest? Hell yes, it is. Oh, this book is kind of written like a found footage film? I'm sold. That's how it goes for me. It's so funny, though, because when it comes to other genres, with science fiction, I'm a bit more picky because I know what I like and I know what I don't like. With fantasy, I am all about not going down a grimdark hole for too long because, you know, when you read that kind of stuff, it, you know, it kind of can weigh on you in ways that maybe horror doesn't for some reason in my weird brain. But I literally will read anything. If something sparks my interest, if I'm reading and there's a couple of words in that blurb that sound intriguing, I'm like, okay, let's see what happens. Do I always make it through the book? No. I am a very firm believer if you are not enjoying a book, you should be able to put that book down and move on. Nothing against the author, nothing against the story. Maybe it works for somebody else, but if you're not enjoying it, why are you pushing yourself through it? So that's what I do. I just find things that interest me. Sometimes it's fiction, sometimes it's nonfiction. With my ADHD, I have a tendency to hyperfixate. So if there's something really interesting to me that I want to read all about, I will. Like, for example, a couple of years ago, I read The History of the Bubonic Plague just because I read an article where the bubonic plague also gave rise to anti-Semitism. And I was like, how is that correlated? How is that related? So I got to read about it and I got to read all these interesting things. And this book was like 700 pages and I couldn't get enough of it. It's just, that's how it is for me. I find things that interest me and I want to read about them.
I think that's probably the best way to go about reading. I know I tend to be someone who likes to try to plan far in advance, but then I usually ignore that because I just read whatever seems interesting in the moment. So
if I plan to read far in advance, that means my to be read list will just and pile will just get bigger and bigger and bigger. Sometimes I'm just flipping through the books that I have and I'm like, oh, okay, I'll just try this one. I don't remember buying it, but I must have bought it for a reason.
My to-be-read list at this point is basically just any book I've ever heard of before that sounds interesting.
Yeah, I know,
and
right.
I don't go too much more in-depth than that.
Yeah, I really should keep track of that better. I know there's many, many good sites that do that, but I'm just like, it's another media, social media kind of thing I just don't need to be a part of.
Sure. So more on your writing, and I know we're probably here mostly to talk about the Green Creek series, but I am curious because I first heard about you through your unofficial Kindness trilogy of standalones. Mm-hmm. So in my head, you were that standalone author, even though I know you've written quite a few series as well. I know that now, but I'm curious, you know, how does your writing process differ from one to the next? How do you decide if a story gets that continuation, or how do you decide if it wraps up in one book? Recently, you might have broken with plan and had the standalone of House in the Cerulean Sea, then expanded to a sequel. So I'm kind of just, you know, curious how that process goes for you.
Yeah. So In the Lives of Puppets and Under the Whispering Door are always going to be standalones. There will never be sequels to those because I think I said everything I wanted to say with those books. Under the Whispering Door was basically me trying to understand grief. I was trying to understand, mm-hmm. I was trying to work through the death of my partner and to see what I could do with words in that regard. And to go back to that, not only I think there's no reason to tell another story there, but two, I know what that book means to a lot of people, and I know what it means to me, and to put myself in a position where I could potentially damage that in any way, shape, or form, I don't think that that's necessary. In the Lives of Puppets, it was always meant to be a one-off thing because I knew how I wanted that book to begin. I knew how I wanted it to be in the middle, and I knew how I wanted it to the end. And by the very nature of that story that I told in that novel with the main character, Victor, to continue that would just feel dishonest in a way because I love, more and more writers should be more comfortable with telling potential readers, potential listeners, you know what? I think a story is very good. This story that I wrote is very good. I will say the ending of In the Lives of Puppets, specifically the very last chapter, I think it's some of the best writing that I have ever done. And I would just, to undermine that by doing something more, just wouldn't feel right. However, with something like The House in the Cerulean Sea, I have this thing, how I write, and it gives a pretty good indication of the fact that I could have either grown up to be a writer or psychotic, is that I have voices in my head. My characters talk to me all the time. And when I finish with a story, usually those characters go quiet, like Victor and Rambo and Nurse Ratched from In the Lives of Puppets and Hugo and Wallace and May Nelson from Under the Whispering Door, they're always going to be a part of me because I wrote them, but they don't necessarily talk to me in the way that they used to, and their story is done. When I wrote The House in the Cerulean Sea, it was going to be just it. That was just going to be the story. But then a couple of factors came into play that, A, those characters have never shut up, ever. Specifically Chauncey, who is my favorite character, probably one of, if not the my favorite character I've ever written. I love him ridiculously so. And
still waiting on his mystery detective series where he's a bellhop.
I know. And there's just this beauty about that world that there an argument could be made that it was a lightning in a bottle moment because that novel came out right when the pandemic exploded in the United States. And people needed something to turn away to look away from all the horror and the strangeness of the world outside. And I think that book came out exactly when it was supposed to. Do I wish the world had never had to go through what it did? Absolutely. But it did. And I think that book came out right when it was supposed to, which is why it's so important for me that I distinguish this next book as being something completely different. If you're going to this book looking to get the exact same feeling that you had when you read the first book, you're not going to, because it's not supposed to do that. It was supposed to people change, people grow. It's been 4 years since the first book came out. It's been 6 years since I started writing The House in the Cerulean Sea. And the world that we live in now is not the world that we live in when I wrote the first book. I wrote the first book because we had a pretty awful president at the time who was basically evil and telling the world how evil he was, and people were falling for it. And I wanted to put some good out in the world. And look where we are here in 2024. We're getting ready to do a rematch of those same old white guys. So that's amazing.
Yep.
But I digress. This book, I'm going to be perfectly upfront. This book, Somewhere Beyond the Sea, the sequel to The House in the Cerulean Sea, was written for one very specific reason, aside from the characters never shutting up. If you have been paying attention in any way, shape, or form in the United States, and particularly in the UK, you know that there is an extraordinarily rising anti-trans agenda. There is anti-trans legislation. There are people in this world who honestly believe that trans people should not exist. And again, it's the whole idea of loving quietly and hating loudly. These people are very loud in their hate. So much so that in 2021 and 2022, and continuing on even through now, when parents of trans people or trans people themselves go to testify in front of Congress, in front of Senate, in hearings and stuff like that, there are two camps of Republican response. There is the smile and nodding, saying, we hear you, we understand you, and then immediately go turn around and vote against trans people right after that hearing. Or B, there are the people, the right-wingers who are up there supposedly representing this country, demanding to know how trans people's bodies work, how their mental health is, who has the right to, or why do they think they need autonomy over their own bodies? They're basically being grilled about why they exist. And that is so disgusting and so infuriating to me that this is our government, and it is so broken that we allow such things to happen. And these brave people who are going there fighting for their lives only to turn around to see their elected officials spitting in their faces? That's disgusting. That's horrifying. I wrote The House in the Cerulean Sea sequel directly in response to the anti-trans agenda that is spreading throughout the world. I wrote it directly in response to that because trans people, A, deserve to live free and protected and know happiness, and B, they deserve to know that they have an entire queer community fighting behind them. And that means lifting up our voices. And that was always the message in the first book, that the power of the few can change the minds of many. And that is why I continued this series, because I know how it feels to be othered. I know how it feels to seem like you can't relate to the people around you. In the first book, I talked about otherness. I talked about how perceptions of people cannot be all that there are, that we have to learn and we have to grow. And that's what I did in the second book. And only this time it's from the perspective of Arthur Parnassus, because nobody else could have told the story other than him. And I am so excited for this book. I am so thrilled for this book. This book that was supposed to come out in 2025, but I actually asked to be moved up to 2024 to make sure it came out before the election, because I want people to know what this country is fighting for at this moment in time. We have so many things that are going on in the world, so many horrible things that are going on all over the place, but we cannot forget. Us in the queer community, our allies in the world over, cannot forget that trans people are under attack at a level that is beyond anything I've seen in my lifetime.
Yeah, I'm also very anxious about how the rest of this year will play out for, you know, those larger reasons, but right. I'm very happy that we'll have this book in it.
Yeah, and I'm thinking about it a lot lately. And again, when House in the Cerulean Sea came out right when the pandemic exploded, and it was a lifeline for a lot of people. This book comes out in September. 2 months after that is the election in the United States. That whole time is going to be a nightmare for so many people. And if I can give people just a little bit of an escape away from that, then that's what I want to do.
I love that. And I've always been a huge proponent of escapism is immensely valuable. And I hate when people say, oh, yeah, you know, you just read that escapist stuff to get away from the real world.
Like, again, please, 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 please read what whatever you want, whether it be comic books, whether it be audiobooks, whether it be romance, whether it be dark romance, smutty romance, if that's what gets you reading and that's what makes you happy and that's what makes you continue to read, read whatever the hell you want.
Absolutely. Well, I think your publicist might have words with me if we don't talk about Green Creek a little bit, since there is that re-release here. But yeah, so I guess for people who may not be familiar, maybe they found you through other works, what is your pitch for the Green Creek series?
The Green Creek series is a 4-book series originally published from 2016 to 2019 that was purchased by my new publisher. I've been with him for 4 years now, my publisher, Tor. Okay, this book, when I first wrote it, I first started writing it 10 years ago in 2014, Wolf Song. When I first started writing this book, there was nothing supernatural, paranormal about it. It was going to be my take on a Romeo and Juliet type situation with warring families and two boys that found themselves growing up in this world. I was 30,000 words into that manuscript. It was going fine. And then my stupid brain said, what if they were werewolves? And I said, what? What are you talking about? And my brain said, no, but wait, what if they were all werewolves? And of course, me at the time, this is 2014, I didn't know what the hell I was doing or talking about or even who I was really. So I was like, I don't write books like that. I write literature. And of course, you know, my brain was like, stop being such a dumbass and get that chip off your shoulder. And so I did. And for some reason, I turned this series that was meant to be about a Romeo and Juliet spin to a story, to a decades-long, million-word saga about a family of werewolves and the people around them in a small town in Oregon. And when the first book came out back in 2016, the reception it received was unlike anything I had ever experienced before. The fandom around the books that grew up quite quickly is ravenous. They are protective, and they let you know when you do something that they don't like. And I love that. I'm okay with that. I love that because nothing they say will change what I do. I'm going to write the story how I want to write it. But these books, these four novels have meant so much to so many people. And I'm so thrilled that we're in the year of our Lord 2024 talking about hardcover versions of Green Creek released by Tor Books. That just blows my mind. Each book follows a different main character, but it's all still set within the same family. You know most of the characters that you'll meet for the rest of the book by the first book. And it is this wild and crazy world where I got to emotionally destroy so many people, and still somehow stitch their hearts together by the end of each book, only to re-traumatize them when the next book came out. And it has been a blast, especially now with these re-releases, seeing the Green Creek fandom versus all the new readers I've gotten, basically sitting in the corner, twiddling their thumbs, doing that meme saying, there's a storm coming, and you have no idea. And it's so wonderful. So wonderful. At an event I did last week, it was for Heart Song, the re-release of Heart Song. I asked how many people, and there was a few hundred people there. I asked how many people had read Heart Song already. Half the people raised their hand. And I said, okay, the other half, you haven't read it, raise your hand. They did. And we all pointed at them and laughed because we know what's coming in this. We know what this book is. Heart Song, the one that just came out last week, is my favorite of the series. It is also the one that I am told most people curse my name over. And I am totally on board with that. So that's the pitch. Yeah, if you want crying, if you want to cry, if you want to rage over dumb werewolves making stupid decisions and then love them again when they turn around and make you laugh on the next page, then boy, have I got a very long series for you.
What I also love is, I know at the time, like, you would tell people, you know, teasers and kind of give them an overview about what to expect for each book going into it. And then for Heart Song, you're like, yeah, no, you're just going to have to go into this.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, back when these were indie published and I was with an indie publisher, there was no such thing as marketing or a marketing budget. So I had to do a lot of this stuff on my own. And, you know, what I love about the Green Creek readership is how they felt like they were starved for information, as if I didn't put out 4 books in 4 years, 4 years of this entire series. But anything I would post, they would latch onto, dissect, turn around. And, you know, by the end of the series with me promoting and posting about it, I got a little cheeky and I got a little saying, yeah, I'm not going to tell you much about this, but Heart Song specifically, I refuse to say much of anything about, because this book, Heart Song, was inspired by mystery box thriller shows like Lost. And it's just, you know, there's a mystery within a mystery, and I'm not a mystery writer. My mind doesn't work like that, but I worked my butt off on that book, and I am so, so proud of the story that came out of it.
Yeah. Well, I love that also you say that you're not that type of writer, but at the same time, I just read Heatwave not too long ago, and I feel like there's some similarities in terms of you keep the readers guessing.
So let me tell you, okay. So if you've read Heart Song, if you've read Heatwave in my Extraordinary series, if you've read even In the Lives of Puppets, you'll know that I play around a lot with memory and what memory does to people. And it was so weird. I was thinking about where that came from and why I got that idea to do anything with memory. And at first I thought it was because, even though my family has no history of it, I think the scariest thing that I can imagine is dementia. Like, that is the scariest thing in the world, because you lose who you are. You lose large pieces of yourself. And I've heard, I was talking with when I was doing research on a different book, I was talking with medical professionals, and I remember one of them telling me it is so much harder for the families of people with dementia than it is for the people with dementia themselves, because they don't necessarily know what they're losing. It's just gone.
Right.
But the family has to witness that, and it's terrifying. And so I kept thinking, where did this fascination with memory came from? And then I remembered, as I was driving through the mountains at night going to my book event in Seattle, I remembered there was a story from some years back that I remember listening to on NPR about a woman who was in a car accident and was then in a coma for a while. And when she woke up, she didn't remember like the last years of her life, not all of her life, but maybe the last 5-6 years of her life. All she knew was, when she woke up, was her family and her husband were there, and she knew them. She had been married for a long time, and she knew her family. And she was in the hospital after she woke up for months recovering, but she kept noticing this weird tension building between her family and her husband, but nobody would explain anything about it. And right before she was released from the hospital, planning on going home with her husband, her family actually finally told her the truth. And the truth was that her husband was abusive, and that she had been involved in domestic violence with him. He had hurt her. And she forgot that. She didn't remember any of it. And she was talking about how it felt like such a betrayal of your body to make you forget something so serious and let you think, oh, there's my loving husband who has never put a finger on me. And so it was just this weird thing that stuck with me, the idea of how your body can betray you, how your mind can betray you. Look, the mind, the brain, doesn't even have enough electricity to light up a single light bulb. And yet it basically contains everything that we are. It is our, you know, there's the idea of the soul in religion, but to me, your brain is your soul, because it's your consciousness. It's who you are. And with ideas like dementia, or with ideas like being in an accident, or even you could be walking down the road one day and all of a sudden something happens in your brain and you're not the same anymore. And we don't necessarily understand why. And so the idea of memory coming into play with that has long fascinated me, which is why you see it, bits and pieces of different forms of memory play or tricks coming into my work, just because I'm fascinated with the idea that our brain, our soul, is who we are, but it can sometimes betray us.
Yeah. And so, yeah, I will say it was definitely, so Heart Song was also probably my favorite in this series. It was definitely very dark and went to some dark places. Yeah. You're not biased. But yeah, no, I mean, Also, I mean, my takeaway after reading the book was, you know, this is a heartwarming story for the most part. Like, there was a lot of light in there to balance out the dark.
There has to be. You can't just have darkness over and over and over and over again, because it wears down on the author, it wears down on the reader. And don't get me wrong, again, this is coming from somebody who loves horror, and if they end with all of the good people getting stuck in some hell dimension or the ghost wins or whatever, I'm like, yes, that is amazing. Bleak as hell, that rules. But there's the difference between being bleak and being oppressive, I think. And, yeah. You know, you can damage characters all you want, but unless you give them moments to shine or step in sunlight or laugh about something, it's not going to mean much. There has to be levity. There has to be levity even in the darkest moments.
And again, I mean, I think I share some of your opinions about grimdark, or at least the extremes of that genre, where, you know, where's the hope?
Right. Because, you know, yeah, even if, like, look at the Star Wars movie, the Rogue One, when that came out, we all knew how you going into the movie, you weren't quite sure how it was going to end. You know that it wasn't going to deal with the beating the Death Star or anything like that. But spoilers for a movie that's been out for quite a while, that movie ends with the rebels, all the main characters dying, but they died knowing what was going to happen next. They died knowing that there was hope in what they did. And if you can't have even that kind of hope in your book, then it's going to feel heavy. It can feel very, very heavy. And don't get me wrong, there are authors who can navigate that wonderfully and do very, very well. I can't do that.
No, hope definitely, I think, is vital. And I mean, if everything's dark, nothing's dark to a certain extent, where you're
right,
just kind of
exactly.
Like, your empathy turns off and you're just like reading about bad stuff happening.
Which is why I love being able to make people laugh when moments are scary or when moments are sad. I mean, I've heard from so many people how they're crying in one paragraph and then the next they were laughing. That's so important, you know? It's not because I'm trying to manipulate emotions. So again, in a way, I think all fiction is a kind of manipulation, but I'm trying to make you realize that I don't want you to sink down in one thing too far without reminding you, you know what? Things may be dark right now, but someday it'll be okay.
I mean, that's life in general too, right? I mean, you could be laughing and crying one moment to the next. In a book, maybe a lot of that's accelerated. So it's literally the same paragraph versus life might be, you know, weeks or months. But I mean, you've got to have that, you know, give and take, light and dark.
You have to. And especially with the climate and the world that we live in at this point in time, if you're not laughing, you're going to be crying a whole lot.
Yeah. What's next for you? So where do you think I don't even just mean specific books and all of that. Like, where do you think you'll go from here as a writer? I mean, you've had a few different types of books over the years. You've done standalones, you've done series, you're with a new publisher now, I guess. So yeah, what do you see the road ahead of you looking like?
It's interesting. I'm something that I'm getting more and more intrigued by are short stories. I think that short fiction is an art that very few people can master. I think short fiction is much harder than writing a novel. I mean, you have to give a novel's worth of emotion and feeling and motivation and story in 10,000 words. And so I want to get better at that. Something that I aspire to do as a writer is to get a little bit better every single day. Do I always do that? No, absolutely not. I'll never be the world's best writer. I'll never be the greatest writer, and I don't want to be. All I want to do is get a little bit better every day. So part of that means changing up some of the things I do. So this summer, we'll see the release of a short story from Tor.com. It'll be free online. It's a 10,000-word semi-prequel to In the Lives of Puppets. It doesn't involve any of those characters from the In the Lives of Puppets. There's no Vic, no Hap, no Nurse Ratched, no Rambo. Instead, it's set hundreds of years before that in a time when machines and humans coexisted, a little bit further in the future than we are right now. And it's my take. It is my first published work that is more horror related. It's not body horror. It's not gross out horror. It's more the type of, oh no, something is wrong. And it just keeps feeling wrong all the way through until you realize what is wrong. And I am so proud of this story. It is a really, really it took me a lot of work. I know it may not seem like it to people who are listening, but it can be harder to write a 10,000 word short story than it can be to write a 120,000 word novel. And so I want to continue looking into short fiction. I have an idea for a book that is not a novel, but it's not a short story collection per se. It's more of an event that takes place that is covered from many different perspectives and just shows little bits and pieces of certain lives across this event that occurs. I think that would be interesting to do. Beyond that, we have the hardcover re-release of Brother Song this year that comes out this summer. We have The House in the Cerulean Sea sequel, Somewhere Beyond the Sea, that comes out this fall that is probably going to make a couple of you very happy to hear about. And next year, I'll say that I have a book about a dog that I'm currently editing that will be released next year that tells the point of view of a story from a dog who thinks he's immortal and then finds out he's not and then has a nervous breakdown and then wants to spend the rest of what he thinks is going to be his very short life, even though he's only 1 year old, trying to make the people around him happy before he goes. He's a drama queen and I adore him. That book is called The Stars Look Like Home, and it's going to be, it's my take on Milo and Otis and Homeward Bound, the stories that I watched when I was a kid and books that I read. After that, right now, all I'll say is this: I'm writing the novel that I've always wanted to write. I'm writing a book right now, the book that I wanted to write for many, many years, but I was not equipped to do so when I was younger. I didn't know how to do certain things. I needed to become a better writer. And again, I'm not saying I'm the best writer by any stretch of the imagination, but I'm confident enough in my abilities now to tell this wild and crazy story that is essentially my version of Robert McCammon's Boy's Life, which is one of my favorite books in the world. It is an adult novel about a group of boys that discover something extraordinary and dark in their town, their small Oregon town. And it's about the decline of the lumber industry, which I know fully well about. My entire family was made up of loggers. It's about poverty. It's about racism, because a lot of people don't like to talk about it, but Oregon is a very, very racist place. And it is going to undoubtedly be the biggest book I've written. And I am so excited to see where I go with it.
Yeah. Well, I think I probably speak for a lot of our listeners and a lot of your readers. I think we're excited as well. I know you have talked before just about your ideal notebook. You mentioned it in this talk, but I know you've had like Western and space opera ideas in the past. Any chance we might see one of those in the future?
Yeah. So the Western idea that I have, funnily enough, is related to Green Creek. And I would want to tell, so I want to tell a prequel that explains, well, not explains, because that sounds kind of reductive, but I want to explore why Green Creek is as powerful as it is to those characters. But I want to do it in a way that would not touch the characters that are already there, because I've already put them through enough crap and writing any more would just wouldn't do. So I'm thinking of writing something that I wanted to write for a long time, and that is cowboy werewolves. So we'll see what happens one day. But yes, I want to do a space opera. I want to do also a different kind of story about space. I have this idea for a three novella story about a spaceship and its crew that is not about horror or finding aliens or having aliens eat you or anything like that. It's all about understanding how small we really are in the face of the universe. And I have an idea for something like that. That would be cool. But hell, man, I also want to write a horror novel. I also want to write a haunted house story. I have so many ideas and only one lifetime to do them. And I'll never be able to get everything out that I want to write. And I'm very fortunate in that regard.
Yeah, that's why as someone who likes to ask questions of authors, one of my pet peeves is whenever people ask, oh, you know, where do you get your ideas from? Because consistently what it seems like almost the answer is for everyone is I have more ideas than I could ever do anything with, right?
Oh, yeah.
Like it's not the idea itself. It's what you finally get the chance to work on.
Right, exactly. And sometimes, though, I will say that they can spring up out of nowhere. Like, the only reason In the Lives of Puppets exists, I'd wanted to do something with a retelling of Carlo Collodi's The Adventures of Pinocchio, but I wasn't quite sure how I wanted to do it until one day I bought a Roomba vacuum and put, like humans do, I put googly eyes on it and watched this stupid little machine, whose name is Hank, by the way. When they first start, they have to map out your house so they know where to go. This little frickin' dork got himself stuck in a corner and made the saddest beeping sound I've ever heard a machine make. And all of a sudden, there was Rambo, fully formed in my head. And oh, what you know, there's Nurse Ratched right next to him. There's Victor, there's Hap, there's Geo. That story exploded in my head in a way that a story has never done before. And it was because I was a slave to capitalism and bought a Roomba vacuum. It's just the weirdest thing. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, what do you, TJ, hope that readers look for when they pick up a new novel you write? Especially since, I mean, you've spanned the gamut of multiple genres, target audiences, all of that. What do you hope that core TJ Klun aspect is that readers are looking for?
The characters, first and foremost. I am a character author first. I'm a character-driven writer. Even though, some say, The House in the Cerulean Sea, which is more slice of life, versus Green Creek, which is more action and plot-oriented, it will always, always, always be about the characters first. Because even if you don't feel something for the villains in a story, then, you know, what am I even doing? I want you to feel like that these people could be real. We know they're not real. They're fiction. They may feel real to me, but to everybody else, they're fiction. But I want them to feel like they could be real to you. Even the bad guys, even the people you don't like in the story, I want them to be human in a way that leaps off the page, whether you agree with them or not. And that's something that I've heard from a lot of readers is their favorite part. And that's something that I always will continue to do, putting my characters first.
Well, I mean, as a reader, I like the characters the most out of any aspect in a story. So
yeah, me too.
I definitely appreciate
that.
That's
what I do too. You know, I it's disappointing when you read a book that sounds like it's going to be great, but then the characters are just, you know, it sometimes, yeah. I can push through it to get to the plot and over that kind of stuff. But man, give a little shine to your characters every now and then. Let them stand out from the plot itself.
Well, is there any media you've consumed lately and can recommend? And I like to say it like that because I'm talking books, games, podcasts, TV, anything.
Oh, yeah. So I am currently through my... Oh, my God. This is so embarrassing. I'm currently through my fifth replay of The Last of Us Part 2. The remastered edition just came out because it needed to remaster after only being out 4 years. So I've been playing that. What's so funny is one of the writers on that game, Haley Gross, who wrote the game with Neil Druckmann, was a fan of The House in the Cerulean Sea and reached out to me, and I recognized her by her name. And I said, did you write The Last of Us Part 2? And she goes, yes. And I go, I'm in love with you. I'm a homosexual man and I'm in love with you. What else am I doing right now? Oh, I'm reading a book that I am adoring because it is I think I brought it up a little bit ago. It is a found footage horror film, but in book form. It's called Last Days by Adam Neville. He's the one that wrote The Ritual that was made into a horror movie on Netflix, which is just remarkable. I love it. I love it. I love it. And in terms of TV, I'm back on my bullshit again, which means I'm watching only British cop procedurals where everything is raining, nobody has any guns, somebody's been murdered, and it takes 6 episodes to find out who did it. And by the 6th episode, they know who did it. And then if there's a second season, it probably won't come out for 6 or 7 years because that's just how British television works. But I am that guy who is subscribed to BritBox and Acorn TV just so I can watch British murder mystery procedurals. And I regret nothing.
I regret nothing. Yeah. Well, so I am definitely interested about that book. You said those found footage horror in book form. I only have read one book like that before, and I thought for sure you were going to say it was Episode 13 by Craig DeLuey, because that's what I read, and
wait,
I really enjoyed that.
Episode 13, but... do I know that one? Because that sounds familiar. Episode 13. Yes, I have that one. I've read that one too. That is exactly it. I think that may have what led me to, because you know how on book buying, like a bookshop.org or stuff like that, it'll show you, oh, these are other titles. So I think I probably got that one and then found The Last Days by Adam Neville. It's just, I love that, man. It sounds so weird to say a found footage film in a book, But that's how it is. That's how it feels. And I'm, that's one of my favorite really genres. Too, yeah. It does. It works so well.
Well, TJ, the way I like to close out all these interviews is just asking you, what is one thing you are excited about right now?
One thing I'm excited about right now, in 5 weeks from now, this is such a, I'm sorry, this is such a personal me thing. And it's me getting excited about, I live in the mountains and it's, there's like 4 feet of snow on the ground. For the next 5 weeks, the town I live in will still have their Christmas decorations up. They will still have all of their lights in because the town I live in is quote unquote the Christmas capital of the United States. So their Christmas celebration starts in November and goes through March. And so I'm going to go this weekend with some friends. We're going to go look at Christmas lights and drink hot coffee or hot chocolate, even though it's February.
That sounds amazing.
It is. It's absolutely amazing. I live in like a Christmas town. Like I, when I moved here to my little log cabin in the mountains, I was like, oh man, this is the start of a Hallmark movie. I'm going to meet a curmudgeonly hot guy and I'm going to have to fall in love and blah, blah, blah. Still waiting on that part. We'll see how it goes.
There we go. Well, TJ, that's all I have for you today. Thank you so, so much for coming on the podcast. This has been a delight.
Thank you so much for having me and welcome back to your podcast.
You can find TJ Klune on Instagram as TJ Klune Books or at his website, tjklunebooks.com. If you've ever needed a hopeful story during stressful times, you just might need to read a TJ Klune book. As always, you can find us over at thefantasyinn.com or click the invite in the show notes to join our Discord server. If you enjoyed this interview, consider leaving us a review online. It only takes a minute of your time and helps others find the show. Plus, it's guaranteed to make my day. And of course, don't forget to subscribe to the show so you can catch all of our future episodes. And I promise, there will be future episodes. That's all for this week. Until next time.